Last two, Weinstein versus 440 Court. Mr. Herman?
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Drew Herman, and I represent the appellants, a group of servers and bartenders who were paid $2.15 per hour while working at the Ridge. This case turns on a straightforward question. Can an employer claim the FLSA's tip credit without proving that all tips from its tip pool were actually distributed to customarily and regularly tipped employees? The district court said yes, but that's not the law. The text of Section 203M2A of the FLSA requires the Ridge to affirmatively show that all tips were distributed to customarily and regularly tipped employees. Not merely that the employer didn't keep any of the tips for itself. The Ridge had the burden to prove compliance with the tip credit. Instead, it offered no evidence showing that the leftover tips from the tip pool ever made it to the bartenders. In fact, the court expressly found there was a gap in the evidence. It couldn't trace the tips to their final destination. And yet, the court still concluded that because the Ridge didn't keep any of the tips for itself, that was good enough. However, the Fair Labor Standards Act permits employers to pay a subminimum wage only if they comply strictly with the requirements for taking a tip credit under Section 203M. The statute is explicit. To take the tip credit and thus pay employees less than minimum wage, the employer must demonstrate that all tips received by the employees were either one, retained by the employees, or two, distributed through a valid tip pool to customarily and regularly tipped employees. This is not a guessing game. It is an affirmative defense, and as courts have repeatedly held, the burden of proving the tip credit lies squarely with the employer. No burden shifts, no presumptions apply. Compliance must be proven, not inferred. Here, the Ridge failed to prove where the extra tip pool money went. The district court found the physical evidence did not show where the extra tip pool money went. The district court also found that neither Ms. Richards, the Ridge's bookkeeper, nor the server managers distributed the extra leftover tip pool money. That alone defeats the tip credit, an affirmative defense for which the Ridge had the burden of proof.
There was some evidence, right, kind of various pieces of evidence that, the bartender received some money from the tip credit, even though they said they didn't, and this and that. Is it possible that that's at least a summary judgment issue about whether the affirmative defense was established?
Your Honor, at trial, the evidence that was presented was the only witness the defense put on was their bookkeeper, who says she cannot testify as to whether bartenders got these tips because she didn't distribute them. That was a task that was allocated to the server managers. The only two server managers to testify, Plaintiff Weinstein being one of them, both testified they never distributed the extra tips to the bartenders. And then the only bartenders who testified, both testified they never received any of the extra tips. So it's unclear what evidence there would be to support even an inference that the tips actually ended up in the hands of bartenders. In response, the Ridge has relied heavily on a case called Kubiak to support its argument that the employer does not have the burden to prove where the tip pool money went. However, Kubiak involved a voluntary tip pool. where employees voluntarily chose to share their tips with the kitchen staff, whereas the tip pool in this case was mandatory. The distinction is crucial because a voluntary tip pool like the one in Kubiak, the employer has no legal obligation or liability with regard to how or what an employee may voluntarily decide to do with their tip money. On the other hand, in cases involving mandatory tip pools, like the one in this case, the employer bears the burden of proving all tips were lawfully distributed in compliance with the FLSA. This requires evidence of actual lawful distribution of the tip pool money, not just a finding that the employer didn't keep any of the tips.
Can you remind me whether there was a difference, and if so, what that difference was between the evidence offered at summary judgment and the evidence offered at the bench trial?
The evidence was very similar on summary judgment as well as at trial.
Okay.
This
is pretty consistent.
Yeah, pretty consistent. Okay. In nearly all of the tip pool cases, the issue is whether a particular employee qualifies as customarily and regularly tipped, and thus is a lawful tip pool participant. Here, we don't even get to that because, as the district court found, there is no evidence showing who received the extra leftover tip money. Without knowing who received this money, the Ridge cannot carry its burden approving all tips were in fact distributed to customarily and regularly tipped employees. Rather than requiring the Ridge to prove that tips were distributed to customarily and regularly tipped employees, the court focused on whether the Ridge itself retained the tips. But that's not the test. The burden is not merely to show that the employer didn't keep any of the tips for itself. It is to affirmatively prove that all tips were lawfully distributed. In other words, the district court presumed compliance based on a finding that the Ridge didn't pocket the tips, ignoring the statutory mandate that employers affirmatively prove all tips were distributed to customarily and regularly tipped employees.
Do you know what the ordinary course of practice is on record keeping in this context? How does it happen with a restaurant that you would say does it right?
Yeah, so one, the FLSA has specific record keeping requirements for tipped employees, but in the restaurant context, in 99% of these cases, the way it works is the tips that are earned that night are divided amongst the support staff. There is no extra, but to the extent there is, it can be directly traced to employees' paychecks. I mean, there's no question. You can
directly trace how, I guess is what I'm asking.
Because you, through discovery, you determine how much was contributed to the tip pool in total, and then they can show through a paycheck that, you know, if there was $100 collected, here are 10 employees' paychecks showing that they were paid $100 in tip share, which, again, under the FLSA, that's part of the record-keeping requirements for tipped employees.
And you're saying that none of the employees' paychecks here showed that, right?
No, you cannot trace this extra to the employees' paychecks.
Do some businesses provide that tip distribution in cash? And at that point, does it become the employee's responsibility to report that, say, to the IRS?
In terms of the employees who receive the tips?
Right.
No. I've never seen it, one, done in cash, because how can an employer then show that, you know, where the tips went or that certain employees actually received tips? Because in most of these cases, like this case, the support staff is also being paid $2.15, so they need a record of showing how much tip money they gave these people in order to meet not only their obligation to the support staff, but their obligation to the servers because they took their money for the tip pool.
I guess we should give you a chance to respond right now to the jurisdictional question if you want to.
Oh, yeah, I hadn't planned to, but in terms of the jurisdictional issue, it was fully briefed. The issue is that some of the opt-in plaintiff, the plaintiffs who opted in, not the named plaintiff, their claims were dismissed. In the cases that you know have gone the other way on this, where
unless what you're talking about is all the claims against a particular defendant.
Well,
now what we have here is all the claims of a particular plaintiff and not all the claims against a particular defendant. But the text of the rule requires the dismissal of an action. I don't see how we can say that's what happened here. It seems maybe your best hope is, I mean, I don't know why lawyers and judges in this circuit keep doing this, keep relying on a rule that we have said repeatedly does not apply. I will at least say, though, that after that was done here, again, the district judge, in granting the motion, did not invoke the rule. So perhaps we construe that as the district court understood the law, which, and it would have been allowed to just drop a plaintiff under Rule 21, which would satisfy the final order rule. But your, it seems to me your argument in the jurisdictional briefing that we should just allow this is just flatly contrary to our precedents. If we're saying that what happened here was a 41A2 dismissal.
Your Honor, and if I may, the way I understand the cases too is one of the alternatives or the proper method is to amend the complaint. But here, where the plaintiffs... Where plaintiff
Rule 21 too.
Correct, Your Honor, and you are right that the court, you know, also didn't cite 41A. And to be quite frank, I didn't know that this was an issue until it was raised in this court, and I have now been.
Before they do these things. Or the rule. The rule says action.
And I'm out of time, Your Honor. If I.
If you have something you want to say about it, you can.
I'll throw you one lifeline question, which is, could you argue, and you may not need to because of Rule 21, that this is the mirror image of dismissing all claims against a defendant?
Yeah, so that was my second part of this, is that the action is the opt-in versus the defendant, which that action was dismissed. And I believe I've reserved 5 minutes.
To the text of the rule to the mirror image situation. Of course, another way to deal with it is the way I suggested was we just construe the district court at least understood it had the authority, and we're going to assume it was exercising that authority under Rule 21 since it didn't cite 41.
But again, Your Honor, I dismissing the action between that particular opt-in and that defendant,
it's a lot like dismissing the action for that particular defendant.
Correct, Your Honor. And I believe I have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz.
May it please the court. My name is Chad Schultz, and I represent the defendant appellee in this matter. Just for a little bit of context, I represent a small restaurant that was basically a supper club that was open three nights a week. Yes.
Can you address your view of the jurisdictional issue?
I mean, I was assuming all along that the district judge had the authority to do what he did under the rules, and I didn't really see that as a significant issue.
Motion asked him to do it under Rule 41. He didn't cite a rule. What should we do about that? 41, at least arguably, doesn't apply. If you look at the text of the rule, it's about the dismissal of an action. Now, we've said where it's all the claims against a particular defendant and the defendant gets dismissed, we construe that as a dismissal of the action. This is a collective action. No defendant got dismissed, only some plaintiffs did.
Yes, sir.
You could look at that as the mirror image. All their claims were dismissed. Apply our defendant rule to plaintiffs as well. But what do you think we should do?
I like that approach. Your Honor, I understand it.
You and your adversary like whatever approach doesn't result in a remand and a redo of this appeal.
I agree with that 100%, Your Honor.
This is the problem. You know, everybody wants to be a pragmatist and ignore the formalism until it gets to be a jurisdictional problem for us.
Yes, I understand. Let me give just a little more background on how this restaurant worked. The server assistants, for example, were told at the beginning of their employment, you'll make $12 an hour, guaranteed. Now, what the restaurant did is they paid them restaurant minimum wage, and then the remainder of that to the $14 an hour, for example, was to come from the tip pool. And the court concluded that that was appropriate, that they had given it to the right people, and then there was sometimes some left over and sometimes not enough. If there's not enough to get you to $14 an hour, then the restaurant would step in and pay the additional money that the tip pool did not cover. However, there was occasionally nights, about half the nights, where there was extra money, $15, $13. And the bartenders had been contributors to the pool, but also the restaurant made the assumption and the conclusion that the bartenders, if anyone was getting shorted on fair compensation for that night, it was the bartenders. So if there's anything left over, there's either one or two bartenders, and we will give that extra $13, whatever it is, to the bartenders. They would put it in an envelope in the safe with either the bartender's name on it, or it would say bar. When the managers come in the next day, they would see the envelope in the safe that had cash in it, and the cash would then be distributed to whoever worked the night before. And that's how that extra, and that is all of the evidence that was presented to the judge.
So I guess the judge made a credibility determination that that had happened, right?
He absolutely did make a credibility decision.
And the pay records of the bartenders?
Yes, absolutely. Well, two things. One, the pay records would be what they were paid, which is the hourly wage for their... What they were making in cash on tips was up to them to report internally, but it didn't show up on a payroll. It didn't show up on their checks, but it was ultimately between them and the IRS. All the tips were paid in cash.
So
now,
let me make sure I understand procedural history here. There's some confusion about this in the brief.
Okay.
And that is, at summary judgment, the district court ruled that the Ridge properly notified the employees about the tip credit.
Yes, sir.
And that the record could not support a finding that the Ridge distributed tips to employees other than those who customarily and regularly received tips.
Yes, sir.
And so the only thing then left for trial was whether the Ridge retained any of the tips, right?
Yes, whether any of that extra was retained by, or whether it was distributed again to appropriate individuals. And so that's when the court ultimately came to this analysis. What could have happened with the money that was...
Whether the extra tips were in fact paid to the bartenders?
Yes.
That's the issue for the trial.
For the trial. And ultimately what the judge said is, okay, if that, the evidence is that that money was put, kept in the safe, limited people had access to the safe. And their testimony was, yes, that cash was put in there with either their name on it or bar if there was only one person working at night. So we've got one of four things happened to that money. Either the bookkeeper herself stole the money, which there was no evidence of. Number two, that the managers who had access to the safe stole the money and didn't give it to the bartenders. No evidence of that. Number three, that the money was actually given lawfully to the bartenders, and that's what ultimately the court decided was the ruling. And then number four is possible, or another possibility would be that the bookkeeper somehow slipped the money back to the house. And there was no evidence of that.
I assume that there's no evidence that the bartenders made reports to the IRS of cash earnings.
Oh, no, they ultimately would have to report, all of the people there would have to report the cash earnings.
No, I know they're supposed to. I'm just wondering, I can't recall if there's any evidence that they did.
There was evidence that the plaintiff herself underreported, but that wasn't really a big part of the case and ultimately wasn't part of the judge's conclusions.
What were the years of this alleged conduct?
I believe it was, the lawsuit was filed, I think, in February of 2019. I can't remember the exact. And we used a 2-year look back, but that never really became an issue either because the judge concluded that the money was properly distributed, that the house didn't keep any of it, and there's no evidence to believe that any of these other four options occurred.
What about the record keeping requirements that your friend on the other side suggests existed for the owners?
They did keep records. Now, it's a small...
Not about this disputed cash, right?
No, that's not true. There were each night, at the conclusion of the night, the money is put into this tip pool. The bookkeeper comes in the next day and works out a sheet for every single day and identifies who gets what and how much of the tip money gets distributed. And there's a sheet that's audited every single morning after that night. Now, what I believe he's referencing is, at the end, let's say there's $13.24 left, it would just say bar, or it would say left.
Right, I guess that's what I'm saying is, the bookkeeper did not, if there was one bartender the night before, did not add $13 to the record of what that person had received in tips, right?
I'm not sure what you mean, because they would put in an envelope that bartender, and then the bartender would get it the next time he or she worked.
I understand all that, but what I'm saying is there's no record of that having happened.
There was record of it. There's a sheet every single day from that day, and then it goes through all of the money that was in the tip pool.
That's what I'm trying to understand. So you're saying that this kind of $13 would have been accounted for in the bookkeeper's description and records of what the bartender was paid for the night before?
Yes.
On that form that they fill out every morning?
Yes, but recognize that's not like a W-2 or...
I'm picturing like a handwritten kind of...
It is.
...column situation, right?
And yes.
So you are saying that document accounts for, although it doesn't say exactly how, but it accounts for the $13 left in the envelope that said Susie or whoever the bartender was. And he's saying, no, it doesn't. Am I right about that?
There may be days where it just says bar.
No, I'm not talking about the envelope. I'm talking about this handwritten.
That's what I'm saying. That handwritten formula, that sheet, At the end of that, there were days when it just said bar, where it didn't have, you know, Mike Johnson's name associated with it.
Weren't they supposed to sign the sheet, whoever was distributing, receiving the action? Weren't they supposed to sign it? But sometimes that did not happen, which also led to some of the discrepancies.
Yes, there were some days on that sheet that were not signed by the manager, but that's not a legal requirement. That's just something they did in-house.
But in terms of the internal bookkeeping, sometimes that wasn't done, which, again, made it more difficult to trace where some of this money went.
There was not any difficulty tracing where the money went. That was not an issue. And it would have been nice if each of those sheets had a manager signing off on them. But again, that was just an internal practice, not anything to do with a legal requirement.
So you're saying that the money was always accounted for one way or the other on the sheet, and
yes,
then there was testimony about kind of how that money was handled, the cash portion of the leftover tips was handled, and that ultimately the district judge resolved a credibility dispute over whether those managers and bookkeepers were telling the truth about what they did with it or not, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And it ultimately came down to the bookkeeper saying,
Richard's testimony, right?
Yes.
She designated the extra tips for payment to the bartenders after allocating the tip pool and would place the extra tips in a safe for shift managers to distribute. She then discussed numerous documents that reflected extra tips were to be paid to the bartenders. She testified she didn't keep the tips nor set them aside for the Ridge. And she testified that Campbell did not have access to the tips and that she had no reason to believe that a shift manager stole them, all of which would support, if you credit that testimony, would support that the inference that the Ridge paid the extra tips back to the bartenders. And that's what the district court did. It credited that testimony. So what we would have to say is that was clear error.
Yes, clear error, that it's not plausible that that's what happened. Exactly. And great deference is given to that district opinion.
This is obviously not an FLSA enforcement action by the government, but is the fact that those records that were kept sufficient legally for purposes of FLSA requirements?
Yes, ma'am. Absolutely, they were.
Was sufficient to write down, say, bar at the bottom?
As long as that money is all distributed. In fact, there's no requirement under FLSA that you would even have that sheet, but you would have difficulty proving without having records. But the FLSA, it requires that you distribute that to the appropriate people, and that's all. But
you're disputing that there are certain record-keeping requirements that were violated, right?
There were no record-keeping requirements that were violated. That's correct. And really, at the end of the day, this is a situation where we've got a disgruntled former manager, and the record was clear that she had plenty of reason that she was angry, whatever. And with FLSA, in this situation, all she has to do is say, not all the money was distributed. I hereby represent everyone. And as a result, my client, who was a small restaurant, produced thousands and thousands of pages of documents, went through years of litigation, and at the end of the day, it's the same conclusion we had on day one. The house never kept any of this money. It was all appropriately distributed, but it is the FLSA the way it is now, and I know that's not what the issue is here today, but it makes it very difficult for a small restaurant to operate and gives great power to a disgruntled former manager who, by the way, was one of the people responsible for making sure FLSA was properly done with all of the people that reported to her. So thank you very much. We respectfully assert that the district opinion should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank Thank you. Mr. Hearn, say 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. I would like to address a couple of points, starting with the court's motion for summary judgment. On page 35 of the court's motion for summary judgment order, the court says, with respect to the final element, defendants contend that they are entitled to summary judgment because plaintiffs failed to come forward with any record evidence to substantiate her claims that the Ridge unlawfully retained a portion of the employee's tips. The court goes on to say, in making this argument, however, defendants ignore that they had the burden to put forth evidence showing they operated a proper tip pool and complied with 29 U.S.C. 203 M2A. And at the end of the court's, so the court goes on to deny the defendant's motion for summary judgment, and at the end says,
retention issue, right?
No, because they, so what they moved for summary judgment on was that they did not retain any of the tips they distributed to the bartenders.
This is what the district court said. The remaining issue in the case is whether the extra tips were in fact paid to the bartenders.
And the court goes on to say, if they were not, additional issues will need to be addressed. And the first one of those questions is,
testimony of the bookkeeper was precisely what I laid out earlier.
It was not, Your Honor. In fact, on redirect, when Mr. Schultz was redirecting Ms. Richards, at the end he asked her, but you didn't hand it to the bartender. No, I didn't. So when you say you don't know what happened to it, is that what you're saying? Yes. I put it where it belonged. And what happened to it after that, I cannot tell you.
Let me go through what I said earlier, okay? She testified, did she not, that she would designate the extra tips for payment to the bartenders after allocating the tip and place the extra tips in a safe for the shift managers to distribute, right?
That's correct.
Then that testimony was credited. She discussed numerous documents that reflected extra tips were to be paid to the bartenders, correct? They were that's what was supposed to happen, according to
that the server managers were supposed to give it to the bartenders,
right.
Correct.
She didn't keep the tips nor set them aside for the Ridge, right? And Campbell did not have access to the tip. She had no reason to believe that a shift manager stole it. Right.
Correct.
All of which the district court credited and gave rise to a reasonable inference that the tips were in fact paid to the bartenders. That's what we have.
Yes, Your Honor.
That finding was clearly erroneous.
Well, two parts to that, Your Honor. There is, the court never found, and in fact, if you go to the court's order, the court says exactly what, the court's findings are exactly what I said. It says, the court cannot conclusively trace the extra tips from the Ridge's safe to the bartenders. Plaintiff Weinstein testified she never hand-delivered the extra tips to the bartenders.
That's at summary judgment, right? So I do think there was that the final?
Yes, Your Honor, yes. So what I was, sorry, I should have been more clear. So he,
based on the evidence before it, that those payments actually went to the bartenders. They weren't kept by the Ridge. And given the evidentiary record that we have here, that seems to me to be a reasonable inference.
Your Honor, he found
maybe not conclusively determined, but a reasonable inference.
So he found that there was no evidence that it went to the bartenders and then inferred that it did, when they have the burden to prove that it did. I mean, he says, it is unclear who was ultimately responsible for distributing the extra tips to the bartenders. And he says, the documentary evidence introduced at trial does not track the extra tips from the safe to their destination. So to infer that they then made it to the bartenders is an inference without any support. Because he's saying, the court found at trial,
what the rules were. They had notified the employees these monies were being set aside. There would have been an uprising if they weren't getting the extra tips.
Your Honor, and the evidence actually also shows, as we pointed out in our brief, they used it to pay flowers. They used it to pay a maintenance man.
That the employees themselves were taking their tips to pay for the flowers.
And
that's a permissible inference from the from this record.
The employer cannot delegate their responsibility to comply with the FLSA to their
responsibility. It's something that the staff has the charitable discretion to do.
I would disagree with that.
They can't do that?
No. It's tip pool money that doesn't belong to them. You have to remember, this is a restaurant with multiple, it's not their money.
The extra tips do belong to them. That was the entire point.
No, to the servers, but you can't make a decision as one individual on a night that this is what I'm gonna do with other people's money.
No.
Because
that's
not everyone.
That's who made that decision, but if the staff itself made that decision, they could do that.
And there is no evidence that the staff made that decision. And again, it would be the defendant's burden to prove that. And there is no evidence of that.
No, but nor is it proved that they did it.
You're correct, Your Honor. But the fact is it's their tip pool. And I'm past my time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. I think we understand your case. We'll move to the last one. Talk to back.